ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Natasha Mitchell with ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. Big thinkers at the best live events. And what bigger idea is there than the end of civilization as we know it? Are all the signs already there, and are we just ignoring them? I'm taking you today to the Festival of Dangerous Ideas.
What's the most dangerous idea to people who have wealth and status in society today? It's the idea that the whole society, the whole of the society that they've been successful within, is actually now illegitimate and coming to an end. Because if we realise that, then we don't have an automatic reason to respect the systems that have produced their wealth and power and status. So I think that's quite a revolutionary shift in perspective. And it has been for me and so many people I know.
Are you ready to break together and not apart? Look, for decades, Jem Bandel thought he was doing good, meaningful work. He worked on environmental and development issues with the UN, with large corporations, with NGOs and politicians, and as a professor in sustainability leadership in a business school. Then he quit. He co-founded an organic farm school in Bali. He started playing devotional music in a band. And a paper he penned called Deep Adaptation, A Map for Navigating Climate Tragedy, exploded. Across the world, it went viral big time. In it was a wake-up call for his former colleagues and the environment movement, parts of which Jem now claims are perpetuating, what he provocatively calls a fake green fairy tale. Some climate scientists have taken his climate claims to task, but his thesis also inspired many in the Extinction Rebellion movement, which uses non-violent civil disobedience to urge governments to act now on climate change. He founded the Deep Adaptation Movement and Forum and the Scholars Warning Initiative. And his book, Breaking Together, A Freedom-Loving Response to Collapse, makes the case for why he thinks we aren't just on the brink of civilizational collapse, but that all the signs are there for it having already begun. He joined me on the stage at the Festival of Dangerous Ideas to give a talk and then share a conversation with me. Please welcome Jem Bandel.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Hello. So thank you for coming to what could be the start of a rather depressing afternoon. I think if you're talking about societal collapse, you're actually feeling your own mortality. And I think that's why a lot of people don't want to look at it. But it's also why a lot of people find it so transformative, because it really minimizes everything else. You don't end up sweating the small stuff. And so it's certainly been huge in my life looking at it this way. But yeah, it's the first time I'm back in Sydney since 2007. 17 years ago, I was working at Griffith Business School, and I came down here to, I think it was Macquarie Bank. I was going to meet some finance executives there to talk about whether we might collaborate. So basically, you know, our ideas, their money. And I don't really quite remember too much about why we didn't get the money, but I do remember they're sitting in the reception and seeing all these people come in with their sort of very black, shiny, clickety-clack shoes across the marble floor, and then looking down at my shoes and seeing my scuffed brown ones and thinking, okay, this isn't going to work. I don't quite fit in. It didn't also go that well when I met this finance executive and I said that I'm part of a movement. We're trying to make fiduciary duty bigger to include environmental issues, so people like you have to, like, care more for the planet. So it was very much at the early stages of all that, but I was super passionate about it. So when I went back to Brisbane and my pro vice chancellor said he'd received a complaint that I was too anti-corporate, I was indignant because I thought I was at the cutting edge of what it meant to be businesslike. This is the future of business. But I'm looking back on it now and I'm thinking, I was papering over something. I did have a much deeper critique of capitalism and the system. Part of me didn't really believe that we were going to be able to reform global finance and really change everything and therefore fix deforestation and toxic chemicals and climate change. And I was just pushing that to the side. Why? Because I wanted a career. By talking about how to reform business, I could travel the world and speak at big conferences and earn an income and have a good sort of story of self, which had self-worth. So it's probably catharsis for that, which is why I then spent 2 years writing the book, Breaking Together, where it really does explore the more difficult stuff about how we're not fixing things. Over the years, I've come to understand that we humans are very good at selective attention, where we focus on certain aspects of reality while ignoring other stuff, even if it's more significant. When we refuse to see, hear, or accept aspects of reality, it's what psychologists call denial or disavowal. So we can also have implicative denial, where, okay, we perceive the stimuli, the data, but we might accept those as facts, but we ignore the implications, or we minimize the implications. Psychologists also tell us that we do that to fit in, to get along. So self-deception can actually serve us. It does. It helps us calm down, keep things simple, and it helps us conform and succeed within existing systems and cultures. But of course, then it doesn't serve us individually or collectively when things are going badly wrong, such as when those systems and cultures are breaking down, which is what I believe our situation is today. So I hear you're an audience that likes thinking, so it's likely many of you paid attention to these issues, environmental issues, before the billionaires. You've probably heard of climate change before Al Gore or Bill Gates. So you know there's been 40 years of warnings about climate change and all manner of conferences and initiatives and efforts and policies, but we are already in the age of consequences. But I don't want to assume. I want to do a quick poll. So I'm going to give you three options. So the first option is, I'll ask you to raise your hands, but not yet. The first option is going to be, if you believe that climate change isn't such a problem or will definitely fix it, so it's manageable, that'll be one option. The next option is, if you think that society is going to break down in your lifetime with climate change being one of the reasons. And the third option is, if you think it's all to play for, or you don't really know. So you're kind of going to be agnostic on all this. So please, hands up if you think that climate change isn't a problem or we're going to fix it. Okay, I'm seeing, I don't know, it's a bit dark out there, 4 hands maybe. Hands up if you think that society is going to break down in your lifetime with climate change as a key driver. Ooh, my book's for sale outside, by the way. Hands up if you think that it's all to play for, can't predict the future, or just don't know yet. Oh, quite a lot at the back there as well. It's the happier agnostic group at the back. But yeah, so basically half and half, should we say, on those the two options. That's interesting. So yeah, you've probably heard the depressing data before. Things like populations of wild animals gone down 68% around the world in 50 years. So now, wild mammals are only 4% of all mammals on Earth, the rest being us, livestock and our pets. So it's a lot of wonderful humans and beautiful cats, but it also shows us just how much we've destroyed and disturbed the natural world, just what a big impact we have. And climate is changing faster than predicted and with more immediate impacts on forests, soils, oceans, and farming. And the big problem for me is that averages have really given us a misleading impression when we hear of like 1.5 degrees C. That doesn't sound very much, but pre-industrial global average temperatures were 13.8 Celsius. So that's night and day, north and south, so all the different seasons, over land, over oceans. And so we're 1.64 degrees Celsius. The average annual temperature is 1.64 degrees Celsius above that. So that's in 130 years. But the really, really mind-boggling thing and super stressful thing is that's about 0.5 degrees Celsius jump in around 12 months. Now, the paleontological record shows that we did have that kind of warming before, but never at a pace like this. Estimates are about maybe it could take 500 years for that kind of temperature jump. So, to me, it's really odd that people are arguing about me being too alarmist when I didn't even predict it going this fast. And we may get lucky with the end of the El Niño and the Pacific Ocean currents stabilizing things, but it's still an abrupt temperature change, and the implications are unfolding slowly but surely for farmers who are experiencing more disruption around the world. And the food security experts tell us that 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial, within just a few years, we're going to see major impacts to the big bread baskets and therefore the price of grains internationally. So I'm pretty annoyed and upset that mass media keeps telling us a different story to that and keeps making it out that it's people like me who are peculiar or somehow cherry picking. There was a survey done of Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change authors, so the top IPCC, you know, the international climate body, done by the journal Nature. And 2/3 of all respondents said that they believed there would be catastrophic climate change in their lifetimes. So my assessment since 2018 publicly that is not at all unusual. And yet, as we saw in the Sydney Morning Herald, was it yesterday or the day before, when they write about it, they may quote me okay or whatever, but the framing is still there that this guy's a bit of an oddball and, you know, the serious people still think it's all manageable and fine. No, the people they're quoting are the outliers now, and it's just quite a few people are very uncomfortable about being public about their private assessments. So, okay, there's a lot of rhetoric on this issue, there's a lot of initiatives, but atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide and methane are going up at near unprecedented rates, as are emissions from human activities. Now, the paper, Deep Adaptation, which helped encourage a sort of a new, more catastrophic attitude amongst environmentalists, which got people out on the streets doing silly things like getting arrested. That was sarcasm, by the way. I was reviewing the climate science in 2017 as an outsider. I hadn't done climatology since university as part of my geography degree at Cambridge, where I did quite a lot of work on it within oceanography. But when I went back to that science, I immediately thought, well, I want to look at the Pacific Ocean and study that and see what's happening there. And also I thought, what's the most obvious indicator of a change to the whole climatic system? It would be sea level rise. Because sea level will only rise globally if there's thermal expansion of water or ice melting from the land and entering the oceans. That's what would happen. And therefore, if we want to have an idea of whether climate change is increasing its pace because of self-reinforcing feedbacks, then we should look at sea level rise. And there was initial data there ready that we were seeing an accelerating pace of sea level rise, which would therefore mean not so much of an issue for sea level because it's going to take so long for it to flood cities. But what that means is the whole climatic system is changing it at an accelerating pace. And that was not normal science then, but now it is. It's widely recognized and it's published on. But the climatology profession are not publicly acknowledging what that means, which is that there's a certain amount of momentum in the system. We're living in the age of consequences already, and it's going to get worse. So this is probably why there are opinion polls that find, not just in Australia or England or Indonesia, but worldwide, that we don't have such a positive view of the future anymore. We don't think our kids will have a better life than ourselves. And of course, when people hear me or hear that, they tell us to cheer up. But I think the data proves that we're just being attentive. And in my book, I went looking for all these different data sets on standard of living and quality of life. And I found one huge data set on quality of life that shows that it's been plateauing in 90% of countries since 2016. In 2016, 90% of countries have a declining quality of life for the average of the population. And because it's a global phenomenon, it means it's very popular at the moment for the mainstream media to say, well, things are okay, they'll get better. But for the alternative media, the popular opportunist YouTubers, to come up with all manner of reasons about why things are getting worse. But because it's a global situation, we can't blame it on a stupid politician or a war or too many immigrants or the West losing confidence or not being religious enough or gender fluidity or not having enough kids or maybe a deep state cabal that wants you to eat bugs. We can't blame it on any of that. Instead, it's indicating something very fundamental, biophysically. And in my book, Breaking Together, I connect the cracks on the surface of modern societies to the crumbling foundations in our basic systems, economic, energy, environmental, and food systems. And I concluded we reach a point now where most modern societies, while continuing to function okay-ish for some people on the surface, are already in their early stages of collapse. So if you don't have to work a second job at the weekend to pay the bills or just sit tight at home, not spending anything so you can afford your next mortgage repayment, you might be lucky enough to come to a festival like this and entertain, and be entertained. I'm the entertainment, by the way, if you hadn't realized. But, you know, even privileged people like us here today are now experiencing the consequences. You already know. In Australia, you had 7.5% food inflation last year. And it's happening around the world. And there are good studies to show that at least a third to a half of this in most countries is to do with damage to agriculture through strange weather. And as economic growth becomes more and more detached from improvements in people's lives in terms of real wealth, just through, you know, magical monetary policies to keep the show on the road, it's kind of papering over the reality that even middle-class people are facing. I did a little bit of digging yesterday on the situation here in Australia. So half of young adults in Australia under the age of 30 are living with their parents. Now, I don't mean to be rude, but that used to be a sign of failure. And it's probably not connected to that, I don't know, but your Data Bureau statistics says that mental health disorders amongst young people have soared by nearly 50% in the last 15 years. So all these stresses and things, they translate into various different mental health disorders. And so, yeah, for me, collapse, societal collapse, it's a process. It's happening. It's not something somewhere else at some other time. So it's a way of framing what we're already experiencing. And I think that recognizing it that way, getting it off our chest, can actually be liberating because it allows new ideas to emerge. But I know I was in denial for years. And there are infinite distractions which help keep us in denial. That scientist was rude on Twitter. That billionaire flies around in jets to talk about this, or he wants us to eat bugs. Or coming from another angle, surely we always fix everything with technology. We're invincible humans and we're going to populate the galaxy forevermore. Or another distraction might be, people always get a little bit depressed and worried. Do you remember Y2K? All these catastrophizing people. We all sort it out. Or conversely, I know people who say, oh, Jem, we're far too small on planet Earth. It's immense. This is silly to think that we can change anything at scale. And then other people who actually then listen to me and think, well, it might be true, they say, well, Jem, you can't lose hope. Otherwise, people will do nothing. Or even worse, you'll go out and glue yourself to something. You know, so there's all this kind of like, you know, again, the implicative denials. I mean, no. Might be true, but, you know, is it really useful to know? So for me, all these distractions are part of a sort of a grin and bear it attitude, which helps to maintain the status quo. Because what's the most dangerous idea to people who have wealth and status in society today? It's the idea that the whole society, the whole of the society that they've been successful within, is actually now illegitimate and coming to an end. Because if we realize that, then we don't have an automatic reason to respect the systems that have produced their wealth and power and status. So I think that's quite a revolutionary shift in perspective. And it has been for me and so many people I know. It invites us to drop compromise and to speak freely. It allows us to rediscover who we might be without all those past compromises. However, it's not all that easy. I have experienced years of being misrepresented in order to claim that I'm wrong, bad, or unhelpful. Attacks for which I'm deeply grateful because they kind of taught me how to sort of have a bit more equanimity and self-discipline and discernment. And I do get angry at times. But for 6 years since my deep adaptation paper came out, I've tried to always just be calm and explain what I did find and analyze and say and what I didn't. And maybe I just got bored of that, because today I'm going to do something different. This morning I released a new essay on jembandel.com, my blog, where I claim the environmental profession, the one that I've been involved in all my career since 1995, is corrupted by pathological lying. So maybe I finally snapped. but you can decide. I'm going to list you what I call the 9 lies or self-deceptions of a fake green fairy tale and why I believe they are now harmful to us. Because I believe they're preventing us from fully looking at how we might make this a fairer disaster, a gentler collapse, a kinder one. So the fake green fairy tale claims that humanity can maintain current levels of consumption, a lie. By being powered by renewables, a lie, which are already displacing fossil fuels, a lie, and therefore reach net zero, a lie. To bring temperatures down to safe levels within just a few years, a lie. To secure a sustainable future for all, a lie. And that the enemies of this outcome are the critics of the energy transition, a lie. So the proponents of these green globalist aims are actually going to be ethical in doing whatever it takes them to achieve their aims, a lie. And due to widely evidenced to the contrary of all those things, I think they're not just misunderstandings. And to demonstrate that, because I know for many of you who might be environmentalists, this is quite an awkward message. It was for me, I pushed it away for so long. I'm going to mention a few of these lies in some more detail. So first, the claim that humanity can maintain current levels of consumption is not true. Already humanity is overshooting the carrying capacity of planet Earth. The day this year that marked that overshoot was August the 1st. So we're degrading the capacity of seas, forests, and soil to produce what we need, as well as we're using up critical minerals. So that's even with about 800 million people on planet Earth right now, malnourished. It's about 1 in 10 of us worldwide. And meanwhile, our monetary system is still requiring our economy to expand consumption of resources. And the theory of decoupling that from resource use, it's been debunked by hundreds of studies, hundreds of peer-reviewed studies. We can't separate growth from destruction of the natural world on that scale. Second, the claim that modern societies can be powered by renewables while maintaining our current levels of energy use is not true. Over 80% of current primary energy generation is from fossil fuels. Even if we tried to switch everything to electric and generated all our power from nuclear, hydro, wind, solar, geothermal, tidal and wave, then we wouldn't have enough metals for all the wire or the batteries. For instance, we would need 250 years of current annual production of copper for the wiring of the planet, and we'd need 4,000 times the annual production of lithium for the batteries. And of course, you know, in Australia, mining is a very ecologically damaging activity. And we're going to have to damage trash, in fact, huge tracts of forest to produce the quantities of critical minerals required. And there's going to be resistance to that, and rightly so. Third, the claim that renewables are already displacing fossil fuels is just not true. Instead, globally, renewables are providing additional energy, with fossil fuel use also increasing. There's no sign of global energy demand declining or any policies being aimed at that. And we all know that having a side salad with your pie and chips is not going to help you lose your belly. Renewables are not, therefore, an answer to the problem of carbon emissions from fossil fuels forcing further climate change on the planet. Only policies targeting a reduction in fossil fuel use globally will begin to tackle that, and we see that hardly anywhere, and I think we're not going to. Fourth, the claim that the world can reach net zero carbon emissions is also, unfortunately, a lie, even though it's seen as such a success for the environmental movement to get that policy talked about and in some countries adopted. Not only is the fact it a lie due to the previous two lies I've said, energy production and demand, not only is it due to the limitations of carbon removal technologies to get carbon out of the atmosphere, but it's also because of the fundamental role of natural gas, probably better called fossil gas, in our current industrial agricultural system. We are a grain-based civilization with some estimates between 60 and 80% of the calories we consume either coming from just about 5 grains, either directly or through the livestock and animals we feed with them and then eat. And 60% of those rely on chemical fertilizers produced with natural gas. And a ton of fertilizer is producing twice as much weight in carbon dioxide. So that's even before considering the machines and transportation, all that involved. So As you heard, I'm a co-founder of Beckenzay Farm. We're an organic farm school. I believe in promoting regenerative farming without chemicals, restoring soils, restoring those practices. But I recognize we're utterly dependent on fossil fuels for our current food supply. So the fifth to ninth lies I detail on my blog. You can go and have a look at them, jenbendell.com. I also provide links, because I'm still a bit of an academic, I provide links to everything that I'm claiming. But there is one of the lies, of the fake green fairy tale I want to mention of the rest, the sixth one. It's the claim that all these changes will secure a sustainable future for all. That's not true. It's because both ecological overshoot and climate change have already progressed too far, while ongoing destruction and pollution are too much of a feature of our industrial consumer societies. So the idea that billions more of us can improve lives by being incorporated into that industrial consumer system, I think, is nonsense. Rather, the way that we privileged people live is time-bound and geographically bound niche. So if we really care about people in poverty, really, then we've got to look at new ways of helping them get what they want, and we have to talk about ourselves and do something about ourselves consuming less. And not just us individually, but collectively as countries that are privileged. I don't see people really talking about that. The degrowth movement's really going nowhere politically. And if it did get elected, it would soon be booted out of power when people wanted to, you know, a bit more help with the cost of living. So, why am I talking like this? Because I think these self-deceptions have consequences. And I wonder how much ecological destruction is going to be unresisted, permitted, financed, due to a belief in these nine lies and the fake green fairy tale they're part of. So permits for mining in the Amazon rainforest have already been given by the Brazilian government on the lands of indigenous peoples, where they provide the main justification is the world's need to move to net zero and the fact we need the critical minerals under that forest. Now, obviously, mining is a major cause of deforestation, but it also ignores something else. The fake green fairy tale ignores something else, this very narrow carbon focus. It ignores the science on the role of forests in seeding clouds globally, which reduce temperatures. So it's mainstream climatology sees that as more local effect. But we have good science to show that even the rainforest in the Amazon is seeding clouds in Tibet. And so it's actually, cumulatively, a global effect. And they do that through pollen and bacteria being given off and seeding clouds. And, you know, it's obvious. We know that if a cloud comes over us, we feel a bit cooler. That effect happens globally. But because of this laser focus on just carbon and technological solutions to carbon, you've got people like billionaire non-scientist Bill Gates telling us that trees don't matter for climate. He was laughing about tree protection initiatives or planting new forests. He asked his audience last year, are we the science people or are we the idiots? So we return to self-deception. And there's going to be money to be earned in maintaining self-deception. So I do wonder how much censorship, surveillance, and authoritarianism will arise from those who need to maintain this fake green fairy tale and resist a growing backlash to it from across society. I think, you know, there's going to be quite a lot of money made in it. And this isn't just theory. So people like me are being visibility filtered on social media ever since July 2020. So they use science feedback, Facebook does, and there was an article by Jonathan Franzen in the New York Times that explained why he was now deciding to work locally to prepare for societal disruption because of climate change. And we couldn't share that New York Times article in the Deep Adaptation Facebook without warnings saying, if you allow this content, then your group will be demoted. Mm-hmm. People tried to share, was it last year, an article about me in GQ magazine, one of the few nice articles about me. And again, there was this thing over the top of the image saying, you know, whatever the language is about, you know, rated dubious or whatever. And so that's where we see glimpses of it. I was banned for Twitter for 7 months without explanation. So basically, this sort of deeper critique of the system, this darker environmentalism, which invites us to be much more rebellious, critical, revolutionary even, is not welcome, it seems, by, you know, the duopoly that is Alphabet and Meta. Now, I know that some people say that we environmentalists should not argue amongst ourselves, but I think they're mistaken about who we are. I'm certainly not in the same environmental professional movement anymore as those people who would campaign for policies that will help trash the Amazon rainforest for a false promise of a more electric lifestyle for the richer people around the world. And I'm not in the same profession with people who want us to defer to the systems that have caused and administered this destruction. So I want to tell you about the movement that I think I'm now in. Yeah, over the past 6 years, I've seen evidence that the truth will set you free. Obviously, your own response to this predicament will be yours. But yeah, realizing that we're in a civilization that's past its peak doesn't necessarily mean at all giving up, being hedonist, or seeking retribution. It does involve in letting go what we once assumed or hoped for, maybe some old ideas about how we're decent people. And so in my book, I have a whole chapter celebrating people who've kind of gone through that despair and ultimately found it quite transformative. Many people quit their job to become full-time activists, which debunks the argument that a more catastrophic outlook kind of breeds apathy. And others allow their existential crisis to really just stop postponing what's in their heart and stop compromising with just doing something because they want to earn money. And so a lot of people are just finding ways of slightly reducing their participation in the machine of global capitalism. You have a lot of people downshifting their consumption, for example, and that needs to often happen if you're going to then step back from a job, and because obviously we're all locked into a particular way of consuming and paying for our bills. And it's very difficult. It's so expensive to live the lives that we lead in Western countries. So I really admire the efforts of people to relocalize. Some people can do that in their neighborhoods, and they can try and find ways of cooking and playing and doing stuff together in their neighborhood, caring for each other. It's basically doing more with less locally. It's kind of a relocalization agenda. A lot of people are getting into it because of this way of looking at the world. For me, this is a people's environmentalism, not a corporate one, and it doesn't get written about that much, heard about that much. Some people, though, find the costs prohibitive, and in my case, I decided to emigrate. I decided to leave the UK and go to a country where land and labor are a lot cheaper, and then I could put the savings I have into starting an organic farm, something that would cost me millions back in the UK. So yeah, I'm oddly pleased that I came to this view of the world and I allowed it ultimately to change how I live. But I had to keep working for a couple of years with some discipline and patience to get my life ready in order to be able to make this change. And I know many people push this awareness away forever because they've got responsibilities. Kids in school, mortgages to pay, and so on. And so what I would say is, you can postpone changes, but not indefinitely. I think there's no one right way to respond, but there is one wrong way, which is to somehow just set this aside because it's too difficult. You can decide, well, you're going to look at it more later, and then start planning slowly to integrate, and you can start talk to people about what does it mean in your own life. And there are many, many ways of responding. Some people are just doing quiet quitting. You know, it's considered as somehow a real societal problem, this phenomenon of quiet quitting. I think we could celebrate quiet quitting. If you're doing a job you no longer believe in, okay, go home early and start retraining and start engaging your neighbors more and doing community stuff. Great, why not? I do want to say before finishing that many of the people that I've met in this collapse-aware field worldwide seem to be sharing what I'm now calling an eco-libertarian sentiment, which is they want to resist overbearing authority and this false savior of technology to work locally on environmental protection and adaptation. And of course, we do need to debate what we want from our policymakers in this new era of consequences. But I also think that it's really important that we don't just see that government is the answer and just debate that. And I think quite a bit of the activism in climate activism could be criticised for having sort of focused on that, like how do we just try and get the government to act? And actually many of the people who are involved in Extinction Rebellion who led it at the start are now changing their activism towards more community work and helping communities get ready, recognising that government is somewhat captured and is not going to change no matter who's elected. In my own case, I rarely give talks on this anymore, and I'm going to be moving away from scholarly analysis in how I use my time. So I think I've come a long way from the person that investment banker met here in 17 years ago. I was living out a scuffed shoe story as a well-meaning academic, and he was living out his shiny black shoe story, and it didn't work out. Maybe good. But I think both our stories, although we thought we were doing something about the planet and being professionals, were kind of out of step with what's really going on in the world. We thought we were working on it, but we didn't have the right up-to-date information on just how bad things are and why they are that way. So today I'm far more comfortably anti-corporate. And I rarely wear scuffed shoes anymore, because my life is mainly barefoot in Bali. I even called my band the Barefoot Stars to celebrate that. And it would be great if you just took my work and the fact that I did this book and or just what I've said today as an invitation to look at this topic more closely, make up your own mind, and begin exploring how you might want to live in the more turbulent times ahead. Because it might be too late for a lot of things, but it's not too late to work out how you want to live into this crisis and how you might want to help each of us break together, not apart, in this age of consequences. Thank you for listening.
So, has Jem Bendel's case for civilizational collapse made you rethink your own situation, perhaps? Jem's book is called Breaking Together, A Freedom-Loving Response to Collapse. He's joining you and I on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas today from the stage of the Festival of Dangerous Ideas at Carriage Works on Gadigal land in Sydney. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Let's hear more from Jem.
Thanks for the presentation. A gentler collapse. I could ask you many questions. I could ask you why you think the environmental movement has been corrupted by elites, or why you give climate scientists such a hard time when they're also grappling with the grief that you're grappling with, that you're giving space to. But I want to pick up on this idea of the book has a subtitle. It's called Breaking Together, A Freedom-Loving Response to Collapse. So what is an eco-libertarian?
So I'm drawing upon left libertarianism as a political theory. So for me, although a lot of people in the world intuit that things aren't getting better, in most countries, the only part of the political spectrum that are speaking to that are the people doing nostalgia politics. Take back control, make America great again, elect a Marcos again. You know, it's that kind of go set the clock back. And the centrists and the leftists don't seem to be responding to that. There's still this idea of progress is possible. We just need to have the right government in charge. So I wanted, with my book...
Well, you go further than that. You say that the left and environmental movement are actually have an authoritarian impulse.
So what I'm trying to do is invite a conversation about what would a solidarity-based politics look like for an era of collapse, rather than just leaving that space to the nostalgia politicians. And it is also because of what you've just said, which is that there are many people who've worked diligently in the environmental profession and activism for decades, like me, who become extremely despairing and they end up being quite misanthropic. And they think, okay, market mechanisms haven't worked, education hasn't worked, we have to do whatever it takes to save as much as we can. And they start sounding very authoritarian.
In what way?
Well, they want people like me silenced online. They're really quite happy that Alphabet and Meta are not letting my analysis get seen. I mean, Michael Mann said good riddance when I was banned from Twitter. So there's the tendency towards welcoming censorship.
Well, I think they're concerned about you cherry-picking the climate data. to suit a narrative about societal collapse and civilizational collapse.
Okay, so who would they be? You mean Michael Mann?
Mm.
Yeah, so that's what I was noticing is that, so he is now the outlier. He's one of the very few climatologists in the world now who will say that no, climate change isn't accelerating. So when I have these debates with climatologists, I say, well, I'm sorry, reality is already proving I'm right. So it's like we need to update our understanding of what's actually happening in the world right now, where we're the last 12 months, 1.64 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial. But yeah, do I give climatologists a hard time? No, I've worked with a lot on better communications. There are many climatologists who share my view and do so publicly, and they're not platformed by Sydney Morning Herald because it doesn't fit the narrative. And the narrative needs to be, calm down, don't revolt. And I'm saying, don't calm down. This is happening. Allow despair, allow a spirit of rebellion. And then how is that really going to be welcomed? Why would I expect it to be welcomed?
you're not telling people to revolt, actually, which is interesting. So
no.
In what ways do you see this state of societal collapse that you're arguing that we're right in right now as an opportunity?
So I don't see this terrible tragedy that's unfolding as somehow condemning human nature. Because we were here, you mentioned 60,000 years of Aboriginal presence in Australia. They also used coal. They just didn't create an economic system that made us dig it up and sell it at an ever faster rate. So the fact that humans are here means we belong here, and we just ended up with a really stupid economic political system that drove us to be ever more consumptive, acquisitive, competitive, and polluting. So I like the idea of exploring how we can help each other return to a more collaborative, harmonious relationship with nature. So I'm less interested in blaming your average person than actually looking at the people who are administering and profiting from a system which is controlling us and getting us to exploit nature and each other.
Mm. This so idea for me, that's that the exploitation is somehow innate to human nature,
yeah,
your argument is, well, no, it's not. And there's been plenty of historical examples where people have had to confront collapse and think about adaptation.
Yeah. So that's why I then floated the idea that actually there's quite a strong thread with environmentalism, has been for decades, which is about restoring our opportunity to be in right relationship with nature. So I didn't really think I had much good news to share after I was looking at all of this. And it was halfway through writing the book, and I went back to my old employer, a UN agency, and they were launching their Crises of Inequality report, which basically said that all manner of crises that we're facing, sometimes called the polycrisis, can be related back to gross inequality in countries and between countries. And a woman who's doing a master's in Geneva said, yeah, we all know this, but we also know that if this guides our choices in our career, we'll get nowhere. There's a reason why this is, which is power. And they had no answer to her. And I looked and thought, oh, I've got good news for you. It's all going to collapse. and I hadn't really thought that before, which is that, yeah, okay, things are collapsing under their own weight. And it's going to be painful, scary, but there will be new opportunities in that context.
You talk about resilience, relinquishment, restoration, reconciliation. These are possible paths through collapse.
Yeah, I offered that as a deep adaptation framework for dialogue. So for me, I realized when I was doing this research in 2017, 2018, that me and loads of people in the environmental field had said to each other, well, we can't conclude that it's too late to stop climate change, because then what would we do? Wouldn't get out of bed in the morning. Mm. And that kind of said, oh yeah, we all agreed on that. Okay, yeah, let's keep working. And so I realized we didn't have a way of talking about it. Well, what if it might be too late to stop catastrophic change? Well, that doesn't mean everything disappears. It doesn't mean it all goes overnight. It doesn't mean there's degrees of freedom and stuff to do. You can try and reduce harm, try and learn from it, try and not make it worse. There's lots to do. So I came up with that framework the four R's that you've just mentioned. So what is it we most value that we want to keep? What is it if we try to keep it, it's going to make things worse? What is it that we had before this advanced way of life that was really great that we can bring back? And then reconciliation, which is an invitation to recognize that, oh, you can't get away from the aspect of this, as I said at the start, which is a reminder of our own mortality. And with that in mind, what do we want to make peace with and who do we want to make peace with? And that, to just recognize that big aspect of this, we can't deny that, and some people would label that spiritual. We shouldn't sideline that aspect of engaging with this predicament.
So what do you want to make peace with?
Still make peace with. I've made peace with so many things. Like just last year, I made peace with the idea that I thought on my deathbed, I want to have finally come up with a confident sense of the nature of the cosmos, the nature of the divine, why was I born, where am I going?
Just that little problem.
Yeah. And this was during one of the Buddhist meditation retreats I co-host in the north of the island, Bali. And it just dawned on me that actually it is so beautiful that if I'm true to myself, I'll be dying without any answers to any of those questions. Because I...
Nicely put.
And I finally got okay with it. I was like, wow, because then you have to just surrender into the unknowing. And what have you got if you haven't got nice, simple stories? Well, we're all in this together. This is a weird experience, being alive. Let's all just be lovely with each other. You know, it invites us to something super simple like that. Mm. So that was nice. I was in a Buddhist temple at the time. It helped. but what am I still struggling with now? It's been staring me in the face. Nietzsche wrote about it. Other people wrote about it. I do sociology. It's that as a collective, humans are less interested in what might be truth than what will help us belong and help us get along, feel safe, have a bit of fun. And therefore, oh, what the hell am I doing studying and speaking to people? Like with this idea that I'm inquiring into what reality might be and being courageous and inviting closer attention to truth. That will work with a few people, but it won't work for the majority. So it will never govern the direction of societies or our species. We will be governed and driven by whatever stories make us feel good at the time. So maybe that's the biggest dangerous idea. It doesn't matter.
Let's come to questions. Thank you.
I'm just a local ocean activist.
What do you mean, just a local ocean activist?
Where is that?
In a couple of weeks, I'm going down to Canberra to try and stop a shitty little offshore mine. Got any tips?
What's your name?
Ro.
Ro? Who's joining Ro? I mean, don't rely on social media. If you're going anywhere, then they'll put the handbrakes on and people won't discover you. So we all have to sort of like go back to analog and chatting to each other, face to face, real life. Tips? I don't know.
Talking to politicians. Yeah.
But you're not in the business of protest anymore. You're backing away from protest quite consciously.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that a cop-out?
I mean, or does it matter? You said, ultimately, it doesn't matter. So do I bother to go down?
Okay, I hear what you're
saying.
Thank
you. Thanks.
All right. No, in this context of no longer progress, but regress, of things falling apart, there are still going to be all manner of issues to work on. Child poverty, race relations, gender rights, trying to prevent the worst excesses. We do need to get rid of forever chemicals from our industrial processes. There's all manner of things to keep working on. But if you have collapse as the context, then you're no longer assuming that this will add up to some wonderful future on the horizon. So therefore, that means you'll do it because you believe it to be right, rather than because necessarily any story that will work. Yeah, that's a crucial part of it. It might also affect what you choose to focus on and how you use your time, but so many people are motivated to do more activism than less because of this more catastrophic outlook. So, but no, I don't have advice on tactics, but I can introduce you to people who've got a lot of experience.
Thank you.
Sure. Thanks, Jim. My question is about awareness-based systems change and whether you sort of see a validity in the idea that, I guess, the existential crisis that we're having can lead to transformation of an awareness personally and collectively.
When I'm asked about are we going to have some sort of mass awakening, because when people realise that how bad things are and are going to become and that we can't fix it with some technology and some nice leaders, are we going to have some kind of mass, if not political awakening, some kind of spiritual awakening? I think, yes, we will. And yes, in my world, I'm seeing it already and have done the last 6 years. But also, we'll see a lot more of, we'll have a mass rising of aggression and polarization and blaming scapegoats. Everything is just, the volume is going to go up. So we can just choose how we want to be. Yeah.
Got to be careful not to be the guru, though, don't you?
Oh, no.
It's a risk.
No, it's a risk.
No, it's not. Okay.
I'm an anti-guru.
Yeah, just checking. Thank you. Another question.
Maybe this dangerous idea from Australia is that there is some hope. Subak Australia, Subak's a Balinese word, I work with them, and it essentially is a three-pronged approach, mass behavioural change, policy change and business change. And I, as a 76-year-old woman, have been absolutely floored by the number of people that are doing some terrific things, like Surfers for Climate, stopping offshore drilling in New South Wales, like Parents for Climate, getting, you know, yes, of course, it's not going to arrest, as you quite rightly say, Jem, and thank you very much for your talk. But I do think you could take away some more hope from Australia than the Macquarie Bank man.
Oh, right.
Good point. We'll take that as a comment.
That was 17 years ago. I mean, he was partly right, and I was partly right. So now, actually, you do need to take environmental issues, if they're material, into a fiduciary duty. So we got there in the end, but
hasn't
achieved
it. And not every environmentalist has been corrupted by the global elite, as you suggested, or the green fake green fairy tale.
Good. I'm glad to hear you use the phrase. I just invented that today.
You're right. Go for it.
So my question is that every time there's been a collapse in history, the powerful survive and thrive, and everybody else suffers. So without a revolt, how do you find a solution to that?
I think it is interesting and possibly helpful to study past civilizational collapses. And a lot of people do a lot of that, and it's quite fascinating. But we end up reading off from it what we want to, and different scholars will see different things in a collapse. Remember, often you're just digging and trying to piece things together and make up a story about how things collapsed. My understanding of collapse is not the one we just heard, is that when the Roman Empire collapsed, there was a lot more freedom for a lot more people, and so it might have been labelled the Dark Ages, but actually there's a lot of evidence that it was actually quite a good time for a lot of people. So perhaps there's a cultural assumption that more hierarchy and order is better, and I would disagree with that assumption. Same, we also don't, we often in the archaeology, we look for evidence of buildings and temples and stuff. But when things like the Mayan Empire collapsed, a lot of people were already living in the forest, and a lot of people went back to living in the forests and to seed the next wave of the Mayan civilization. So I think we've got to be careful about any of these assumptions there. It's, for me, it's interesting, but as you say, history doesn't repeat, it rhymes, so there's stuff we can learn. But I'm cautious about making any great generalization. But there was something else in that question, wasn't there? Is that, do we need to try and revolt and take power?
Then you're replicating exactly the same dynamic you're revolting against, which is fascinating. Thank you so much for being here today. Enjoy the rest of the festival. Thank you. Jem Bendel.
So how do you respond to Jem's argument about civilisational collapse? Are you sceptical? Are you worried? You can email us. I'd love to hear your thoughts. bigideas@abc.net.au. I love hearing from you. Jem Bendel's book is called Breaking Together, A Freedom-Loving Response to Collapse. Big thanks to the Festival of Dangerous Ideas for hosting Jem and I. And the festival has its own fabulous podcast and YouTube channel for its events. Check it out. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Join me next time for Big Ideas.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.